Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a show where we talk about data networking, TCP/IP, firewalls, routers, jumbo frames, that sort of thing. This show is number 122 and is part two of the Mission Impossible show number 119, which we published back on October 6, 2012. I am Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter, and co-host of the show, along with at Ethereal Mind, Greg Farrell. Joining us on the show is Michelle Chiburka, at Mrs. YSY, Tom Hollingsworth, at Networking Nerd, Tony Bork, at T-Bork, Aussie Kurt Bales, at Network Janitor, and Ivan Pepelniak, at iOS Hints. You can follow the show on Twitter, at Packet Pushers, like us on Facebook, join our LinkedIn group, chat it up old school at irc.freenode.net and the Packet Pushers channel, and of course, visit packetpushers.net, where you can find all sorts of excellent content by our community bloggers and other podcast feeds. So with that quick intro, let's get to the show, where Greg starts things off.
I've got a fresh topic that many of you may not have talked about. So for example, yeah? I've been writing a report recently for somebody else and doing some research on the future of WAN acceleration.
your favorite topic.
Yeah, I think WAN acceleration's got a place, and it's not necessarily at the bottom of the ocean. There's certain utilizations of it where it makes sense. One of the interesting ones was that in Server 2012, Microsoft's branch case strategy will get a significant boost. And basically what they're doing is using MS Windows Server 2012 to act as a caching device at the edge for all elements. So you can actually say, this is the server, and it's going to cache all communications back to the Windows Server data center. And I'm looking around at other things that are happening in the industry, things like the SPDY protocol, which is about accelerating HTTP to use less bandwidth. And we're starting to see a thrust for applications to start to thin down their fat protocols. I don't think it's going to change overnight, not within 6 months or a year, but even companies like SAP and Oracle are starting to get the hint that actually infinite amounts of bandwidth that is costing customers serious money and is causing them a loss of licensing revenue because customers aren't upgrading because of the cost of the networking side. Now, if that's the case, if that movement continues to protocol optimization and efficient bandwidth utilization from the applications, that's going to cause a lot of problems for WAN acceleration who rely on protocol inefficiencies to deliver their products. So, for example, products like Riverbed and Bluecoat come from two fundamental differences. Riverbed comes from mathematical protocol optimizations to do on-the-fly TCP enhancements, and that's where most of theirs come from. Bluecoat tries to cache it all. Caching doesn't work when you encrypt it because the decryption of this payload is so complex and so expensive computationally that it's hard to do at gigabit or multi-gigabit speeds. And Riverbed's going to have more and more problems because their protocol optimization will become less relevant as protocols become more inherently optimized. And I'm just wondering if anybody had actually sort of still using WAN acceleration and would see those things as changing their future.
In about 2007, like WAN optimization was like the hottest thing. F5 had their WAN jets, which were terrible. They make a great load balancer, but their WAN jets were terrible. You know, Riverbed, Cisco was competing heavily with WAS, and then it seemed, at least to me, it petered out.
Yeah, I mean, people that put them in have put them in, but the technology hasn't advanced so much that there's a big driver to keep upgrading your WAN accelerators, your WAN optimizers. The technology, Greg, I mean, I think you summed it up pretty well. You know, mathematics are algorithms that take protocols that were designed at a different place in time and then make them work over high bandwidth, but also high latency links. You know, is really the problem that those guys are solving. And if the problems become solved within the protocols themselves or with other techniques, then that kind of obviates the need for a WAN optimizer. So one of the things that you see, like I just did a Riverbed deployment for a medium-sized company that has offices in different parts of the globe. And the purpose for that was obvious in that high bandwidth, high latency links, but the offices that are far away from the main data centers, the applications perform slowly. You put in the WAN optimizers and life gets better. And that thought is now, okay, so down to put in that equipment, there's hardware involved, there's cabling involved, there's licensing involved, and now you've got to maintain all of that. You've got to write policies for the WAN optimizers. You need to keep up with them. They have various issues that come up that you need to troubleshoot, such as I'm running RIO 703, and I've got the automatic HTTP optimization tuning turned on, and depending on the application, some of the things that it decides to automatically do aren't good for the application, because the application ends up with some stale links because of the way the Riverbed does object caching from time to time, and you have to defeat some of those things. Okay.
And they get blamed for everything.
Everything.
Yeah, just like the firewalls. You guys deserve it. See, it's your turn now.
So is my life better if I don't have to have this third-party appliance that's analyzing all my traffic flowing through it and optimizing it because the protocols inherently have their own optimization schemes built in? Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. Riverbed is obviously seeing some of this, or at least that's my impression of them, because of the way that they've diversified. They're doing other things as well, too. You can do staging on their boxes. You can run, take a Riverbed box and use it as kind of a Soho device where you got everything in the one box and there's a virtualization engine there, so you can run other, like a DHCP server, let's say, in DNS and a small file server, all on the Riverbed box, ship it out to an office there. There's your connectivity. Welcome to the company kind of a thing. You know, they bought Wireshark. You know, so their intellectual property ownership is obviously changing. And so to me, that's kind of a prediction that they know there's going to be an end of the road eventually for WAN optimization. That seems to be sort of an obvious progression of things as time goes on. So, longest answer to the question, Greg, is yeah, I think WAN optimization eventually goes away, but it's still years out.
Ethan, I don't know if it goes away. I think it'll fade in relevance.
It'll be like Studio 54.
So, Ethan, question for you. How much of what you guys use WAN optimization for is for like file caching, like SMB or SIFS, as we're not supposed to call it anymore?
Well, technically SIF still exists depending on what your age of clients and so on and so forth are, and the Riverbed will recognize SIFs, SMB, and SMB2, and yeah, that is a part of it. It does give you the opportunity to do more centralized file servers, so rather than having to have a file server in your small office that's got 20 people in it, you can just say, no, you guys are going to connect off to the central one, and everything's going to be fast enough because we got WAN optimization sitting there, and that's going to make it a tolerable experience for you to use. And yeah, we do quite a bit of that. I mean, that's a big application, HTTP and HTTPS being the other big application in the environment I happen to support, where I have the Riverbeds also acting as an SSL proxy, where he decrypts, optimizes, re-encrypts, decrypts, unoptimizes, re-encrypts. There's this three-way process to do SSL optimization that the Riverbed can do as well. So those are the big things.
When I was part of a team that managed the deployment of a large WAN optimization network, like 90% of what we did was SIFS and SMB caching. That was the main driver for the entire thing, and it was actually for a financial institution. They ate them up like candy. You'd be kind of surprised and almost scared how much finance gets done on Excel spreadsheets versus like some big supercomputer.
Well, that's a pretty common office or enterprise scenario, office applications needing acceleration. I mean, but the other big play I think Riverbed has would be when you're doing, you're trying to keep a remote site that's a disaster recovery site in sync, but you've got too much data to be able to do it across the pipe you've got. So it's not necessarily a latency issue. It's you really need the compression that the Riverbed box can give you. Typically, I don't know what the magic sauce is there that Riverbed's got, but if you let a vendor do their own compression, typically you do better if you shut off the vendor's compression, let the Riverbed do its own compression and optimization and ship it across the wire. You'll get better throughput overall when you do that. So if you've got two EMC arrays that are doing SRDF, well, Riverbed works with EMC to certify a Steelhead appliance to accelerate SRDF. So when you have a scenario like that and you've got a couple of Riverbed boxes on either end that have got multi-terabit data caches in disk on each end, you can, or disk or whatever your local storage might be, whether it's flash storage or whatever it might be, that spinning disk is tending to go away in Riverbed because it's too much latency. But yeah, you can do great performance for those kind of scenarios as well, keeping big data stores in sync. You know, EMC comes to mind, and also Oracle. You're doing an offsite, you know, a near real time replication of an Oracle database for a failover site. Riverbed plays in well there as well. I can only afford to put up an OC3 between my sites that are at either end of the country. And I can fill the pipe with my database, but the OC3 isn't fast enough. Okay, put a Riverbed in, let it do deduplication and compression and tokenization, and then pump that same data stream through, and all of a sudden the OC3 is big enough and probably even bigger than you actually need. Is it going away? I guess I tend to think, yeah, if the protocols are engineered to be able to do all this same stuff inherently, it's gonna it could go away. But
I think it's be squeezed between the fact that we get more bandwidth for the same price, and some point it's cheaper just to buy more bandwidth than WAN accelerators, and as well as protocol efficiency, as well as the cloud. Because keep in mind that a certain amount of bandwidth is going to move into internet pipes over public networks. And I wonder if that traffic shift away from WAN-centric to cloud-centric. Well, I'm not convinced that's actually going to happen. I personally think public cloud's probably not going to be all that. I think most of the future growth in networking is going to be around private cloud networks. That is, retrofitting new networks into your existing data centers to support a highly mobile service, and I think that's the next thing we'll be talking about in the next 5 years.
I think WAN acceleration is the equivalent of high-waisted mom jeans. Nobody really likes them, and they know they're not flattering, but they're still around.
That was harsh, man.
I think you just made a Riverbed SE cry.
Now, there's another play here, though, in this space that we haven't talked about, which is content distribution networks. I mean, another way to keep a global cache of data synchronized is to leverage an Akamai or someone like that to keep your content close to wherever you need it to be close to around the globe. And I think we're going to see a lot of growth in that space because, you know, there's people that my company does business with, and I can't put a Riverbed in their infrastructure for whatever the reasons are to try to overcome the fact that I'm dealing with 250 or 300 milliseconds of latency, and or the pipes aren't especially that big. But I could talk to an Akamai and say, I need you to store X data set here, here, and here to be close to these other people that I do business with, and then, you know, pull it down from there. Now, it's not a real-time application, but it could be functional depending on what the nature is of the data and how people have to use it in what time frame. So that's another big growth area I think that we're going to see a lot of press on in the next few years. The data sets are getting too big. I mean, people are generating gigabytes and terabytes of data now. I don't care how big your pipes are and how much WAN optimization you do, it becomes almost impossible to get that everywhere it needs to go if you're an enterprise dealing with enterprise-level budgets.
Yes, use the cloud. Use the cloud where it's all insecure.
It's just servers! Sorry, that was my Larry Ellison impression.
It's all software. The future of networking is all software. The latest buzzword I saw this week was it's no longer software-defined networking, it's service-defined networking.
Oh, my. Already trying to redefine a buzzword as it exists?
Like postmodern.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's like a hipster trying to go, the new black is dark black.
No, the new black is orange.
Yeah, that's right.
No. The new black is cardigans.
That's right. It's not black. It's dark black. Yes. That's which was my point.
It's but a slightly darker black.
Well, the other one that's sort of coming to the fore, and I don't know, in the networking sense, one of the interesting things about private cloud networking is, and I saw this buzzword thrown around during the week, was software-defined security. I have I'm currently researching a report for somebody on private cloud security and how you would build out.
That's the last year.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's pretty much solved.
Yeah, there's Zscaler out there. I mean, it's like they've... I mean, I thought it was cool like a year and a half ago, and now I'm so done with it. But, yeah.
So it's going to be – well, I don't know. I was speaking with Juniper this week about their security – virtual security products, and I'm going to be taking another look at Cisco's virtual security products and also HP's, see what Tipping Point's done, whether they've boosted their product set in the last 6 months.
Hey, Greg, Checkpoint has some too now.
Who?
Checkpoint has some virtual security products.
Who? He said who?
Are they still working on Heisenberg principles?
I know I should look at Checkpoint in the IE even for balance, but I mean, I don't even know how to get in contact with a Checkpoint marketing person to ask them to brief me on the product. I don't think they even exist in social networking, do they?
Somebody offered to get me some product manager to brief me on the on their new virtualization security, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll hear it.
I could put you in touch with someone, I think. Someone who would know someone, because he was really in deep with Checkpoint. So, although, interestingly, he's moved over to Palo Alto. But anyway.
That sounds gross. That he was in deep with Checkpoint. Ooh.
Yeah, so deep he went to Palo. And trying to get somebody from Palo Alto to talk to you is impossible.
Really?
Yeah, I've had zero response from Palo Alto, even despite a couple of different attempts. So I've pretty much given up. Over here in the UK, can't find them. Can't see them. They must be like in America only or something, as far as I know.
Yeah, they are getting a lot of share.
I could be wrong, but that's what I can see at the moment. But yeah, so that'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to learning about that, because current dollar day job is all about running up my specific focus as part of an overall infrastructure is to actually manage a bunch of private clouds. I've got four of them, and I have to consider what happens in the security architecture. It's quite an interesting environment, so it'll be interesting to see. Anyway, but you know, you can find a link to the report once I publish it on Information Week in a few weeks.
Oh, yummy. Yay.
I have a private cloud in my laundry room.
That's how you dry your laundry, right?
No, seriously, like, you know, the whole virtualization architecture, all that. Mm. So a lot of us have, most of us probably have something like that.
No.
Am I the only one with a data center in my laundry room? I cannot be.
Yes, I think you are.
Yes. We're pundits. We just make stuff up.
In all seriousness, Tony, I have had that infrastructure, but torn it all down. I just haven't had the need. Yeah. I used to have a web services running out of my house and email and so on, but do not do that these days. But I need to go to VMware training. I'm supposed to get it done before the end of this year. I need to do VCP5, and that may well be my push to resurrect the home data center.
Yeah, I've got like two different hypervisors, a NAS array, and all this stuff. Actually, I had to apologize to a vendor once because they lent me some equipment and I spilled laundry detergent on it. Seriously, it was actually Coyote Point. So sorry, Bill, but that was the most embarrassing professional call I think I've ever had to make, was to call him up and call up the CEO a Coyote Point, Bill Kish, and say, I spilled laundry detergent on your box.
That's a new excuse. What was the laundry detergent actually hiding?
So now I have a new system. I have the laundry detergent on the bottom shelf and the servers on the top shelves.
So what does that do? Did it make it go faster, or is it like Spider-Man being, you know, introduced to radiation? Is you know, when he gets super spidey senses? I mean, did it get
built-in data loss prevention? It scrubs the data now.
Yeah. It made the cloud clean.
It wiped out all of his VRAM allocations, so he could run twice as much RAM in the server as he could before because it cloud washed it.
Now it smells snugly fresh. That's the only change. And there's a stain on it, so.
So Checkpoint apparently has a Twitter account, Checkpoint SW. They don't tweet very often, but they do have 20,586 followers.
Yeah, that's right. Lots of people wear shoes as well because they've got feet. That's mostly the people who own Checkpoint followers.
I think I still have one running. You just reminded me of a project I have to finish. I've got a few VPN tunnels terminated in a stupid thing, and I got to get with some of our folks that are connected to this thing and make it go away.
Well, why did that sound like this?
You guys make fun of Checkpoint, but they still end up in all those in the Gartner Magic Quadrants and the NSS reports. They always end up being – I don't know. Does like the Checkpoint CEO have dirt on all these analyst companies or I don't know how –
Checkpoint buys a lot of white papers from these companies, which certainly doesn't buy them a position on the Magic Quadrant, but it would certainly get them a lot of mind share with the people who do write the Magic Quadrant.
And nobody wants to be the first one to drop them off the list either, right?
Well, my current network doesn't have Checkpoint, and neither I have
referring to the analysts.
That's true. It's very difficult for the analysts not to give Checkpoint a good place when most of their revenue comes from.
No, I haven't looked at Checkpoint for a while, and it wasn't that the product was bad. It was just that it was so expensive. It was really an obscene amount of money when our needs were basic. And it just, you know, I don't see why we need to keep going down this road.
It has so many bells and whistles now. I made a comparison once that Checkpoint is to Exchange the way the ASA is to Sendmail. I mean, it's, you know, out of the box, it seems to work really well. But then when something breaks, it's just a disaster to try and figure it out. Because they mask so many things, but then, you know, like the ASA is kind of, oh my God, it's so, you know, esoteric. But then once you get to that sweet spot, like with Sendmail, it's very flexible. You can do, you know, there are lots of hidden kinds of things you have to figure out. But it's, I mean, that's the only, that's the closest I came to, you know, that kind of, and you guys are all like saying you're laughing, you're muting your phone because you don't like. Is that because my analogy's bad or because it's true?
We're laughing at Kurt's picture of a cat with a golden pistol and a ninja scarf on its head, riding a unicorn that's breathing fire, and it's awesome.
I like that. I don't know where I downloaded it to. I downloaded it, but I can't find it.
There was a consulting company I worked for once upon a time, and one of the practical jokes in the office for a while was to find the most horrible picture you could find and send it to someone who was on the phone with a customer and see if you could get them to blow it in the middle of a conversation. Kurt just had that moment.
Jeff Fry's been doing a really good job of sending me girls dressed as unicorns. He's been writing some training material recently, and he's been sending me updates once a week. And lots of I didn't realize there were that many pictures on the internet of girls dressed as unicorns.
Oh my God!
Is that a thing? Who knew?
Now, if it was wearing a cardigan, that would be perfect for Tony.
Photoshop out.
But going back to Checkpoint, now that I disrupted everyone's conversation, going back to Checkpoint, my problem with Checkpoint is that it's always either too big for what the customer needs at the time, and by the time that they're big enough to need it, they've got investments in other firewalls by then.
Yeah.
So it's there's no point changing to something else. We'll just keep rolling out bigger versions of what we rolled out at the small scale.
Yeah.
For me, it's interesting. There's a lot of ignorance that I have about Checkpoint. I haven't taken a look at their products in a long, long, long time. But it's kind of one of those things that I don't feel the need to cure my ignorance because no one I know, no one I trust, has anything nice to say about Checkpoint. So I never even would consider them. That may or may not be a valid reason not to consider a vendor, but it's the reason that, you know, it's pervasive, at least in me.
It's just highly rococo, and it's Byzantine. It's just so layers upon layers upon layers of stuff, like, shoved into this application that, Yeah, I mean, that's the problem that I have with it. But to some degree, there's stuff that they got right in terms of reporting and logging that just, you know, I hate to say it, I'm going to have to agree a little bit with Daniel Powell on this one.
Ooh.
Yeah, no, but it's, the ASA, I mean, is just so stripped down, and the SRX, then Jesus, you know, I don't know. They're all equally hateful. I mean, firewalls just—they all suck.
Yes.
Someone said something nice about Checkpoint on the Pack Butcher show. I think this is a this would be first.
Well, it wasn't, but let's qualify that. I said that, you know, in a group of things that all suck, they do a
yeah. I mean, the thing is that if the only way to get to the shop is in a Volkswagen, with 25-year-old Volkswagen that's got a shitty engine and it stinks, you're still going to get in a Volkswagen and go to the shop.
Yeah, fair enough.
So in that sense, Checkpoint is like a broken down old shitty car, but it's still got an engine and five wheels, and it kind of works, so you still use it. The only problem is the people who use it, by the time they've gotten over the hump of adapting to, or like learning the product, because it's just so archaic in its forms, and its interface is just so arcane, and its licensing and its, you know, software architecture is obscure in the extreme.
Tony, you know how you were saying you haven't seen the product for a few years? It hasn't changed all that dramatically much. I don't think you'd find it all that difficult to recall what. No.
Wait, which revision are we talking? Like R70 what?
Yeah, it's R75 something or another now, I believe.
Yeah,
I mean, but even you go all the way back to R55, which is, what was that, 10 years old, something like that, and you look at the layout and the screens and the tools and how you get around everything, nothing's different. The rudiments are all basically the same.
Yeah, I last time I dealt with the Checkpoint box was a Nokia Ipso box, and we actually terminated a T1 into it. This is like 99-2000, so this is a long time ago.
Yeah, it's still around. The checkpoints work, but the software architecture is arcane. The interface hasn't changed in 10 years, which attracts a certain type of people who don't like change and don't want to move on and who just want to keep reinvesting in the same old dumb stuff that they've always got. And what Checkpoint's done in terms of product development is actually quite clever. They've played to their strengths and they've added more and more software features on top of the existing code base. It's like Windows, right?
Windows says,
we're not going to throw anything away. We're going to keep everything exactly the same. You want to do BYOD? Yeah, you use our firewall. We've got this BYOD feature. You just add it onto the existing platform that you've already got. Use the existing licenses. You just pay a bit more. There's your BYOD. You want to do desktop security? You want to be able to scan everything at the desktop? Sure, we'll take your McAfee, and then we'll put an agent on, and we'll completely lock down the desktop. Same firewall, same hardware, same software. We just charge you a bit more. And it's a really seductive sort of a sell. It sort of sucks. It's very targeted at management in that, you know, don't worry about it. We'll take whatever you've got. We're going to take your existing investment. You just pay a little bit more and we'll add some features on top of that. And at the same time, you don't realize that suddenly you're driving around, you know, instead of actually ending up with a horse, you've got a camel.
It changes hard, though. I mean, I did a Checkpoint to Cisco conversion. And it was painful. There is no direct way to get from a Cisco to – or a Checkpoint to a Cisco firewall, for example. You got to rebuild everything from scratch, and that's tedious.
Yeah, sure you do, but it's, you know, it's not hard. You just dump the firewall rules out. You extrapolate. You get a secretary in to get the firewall rules, retype them into an access list, and then drop them on. How hard's that?
Or get your security people to earn their pay. Sorry, Michelle.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
actually a pain. Those rules suck. I mean, and then, you know, I love, you know, nobody owns the rules. That's the other problem. You have all these firewalls, and none of them really do a good job of collecting metadata that you need to actually document your firewall rules. Okay, so we're allowing this foreign IP address from Spain to come into our production network. And the rule's been in there for God knows how long. We don't know when we first enter that rule. We don't know whose device it's for and what company that is. You know, that rule, just researching that rule takes like a year, you know? That's the problem. Then you got to buy something like AlgoSec, FireMon, TwoFin, SecureTrack, or now InfoBlox is getting into the firewall management, you know, thing. What pisses me off about these firewalls is then you got to spend oodles amounts of, and I'm talking six figures. You have a significant number of firewalls. You got to buy some firewall management application just to store the metadata about the data in the firewall because they suck so much at collecting and documenting it internally. Like, what are these guys just, is it some kind of like mafia or something? What?
No, I know. And then I went through that exact process. Thankfully, the rule sets I was dealing with were very small. And so rather than dealing with several hundred or a few thousand rules at a firewall, I was dealing with, you know, dozens or a couple of hundred at most. And it wasn't too hard to get through that list. Still tedious, still time-consuming, but I got through it. You know, for me, the problem was it was just me, and I had other stuff to do as well. So it did, you know, that's a project that eats up a lot of time, even for a small firewall cutover. And I think that maybe is some of the resistance, where people are saying, I know there's probably better firewall products out there, but, oh, crap, I just can't face doing a migration. So
you know,
I'm just going to stick with what I'm doing. I can't face that cutover project.
Yeah, but see, you know what? It's like you're just rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic when you switch from one firewall to another one. You buy a different set of problems. First of all, you got to make that migration, and then you still don't have, you know, it's like a lot of the BCDR people tell you, okay, don't put all your eggs in one basket and go with one vendor. You know, have different vendors at each place. That way, if you have a security vulnerability that pops up with this vendor, you don't have to deal, you know, you can mitigate it by having this other vendor in place. Whatever, then you've got to manage all these, this non-homogeneous environment. You know, it's just, I mean, I don't understand why. Software-defined network, let's have a software-defined firewall management that eliminates all this crap of I mean, that's what we struggle with. We have hundreds of firewalls, and it's just it's very challenging to find a single platform to manage them all so that you have visibility, you can document them, you can analyze them for, you know, policy violations, you know, so rule shadowing, you can standardize, and there's just
You throw out SDN in the context of security, and I think as vendors begin to come out with unified ways to manage the network, security is going to be a strong play for those guys. A very strong play.
Yeah, please. Please.
So my question is, when do you go from managing, like at what point, at how many firewalls or how many devices can you justify a management platform?
Hundreds.
I would go much smaller than that, Michelle. You said 100. I mean, I've got a very small number of firewalls.
We have like hundreds of firewalls, and we're not using anything yet. And that's one of the things, that's one of my little, you know, attempts at finding the Holy Grail. Making everybody happy to find something that delivers, you know, monitoring, visibility, reporting, something we can do to collect metrics, to strategize for the future. I mean, it's – and they're not cheap. And, yeah, you're right. So what? How many do you have to have to make it worthwhile? And to be honest, when in my previous job, it wasn't that many to justify it because – the benefit of some of the, like the reporting that you get, I remember buying one product because I had to meet a requirement to be able to remove rules where an object or remove an object in a rule that had never been hit. And Checkpoint didn't have the ability to do that natively, and I found one product that could do that, and that was the pure justification in buying that product because that meant we could say, oh, that object's not being used. We get to remove that in an audit.
Yeah, that's one good reason, the reporting and auditing functionality of a manager. And then another one would be if you have a lot of objects that are common to each firewall that you want to keep synchronized. That's, I think, is another great case. You don't have to log into each individual firewall because an IP address got updated on a system.
Or say you have different divisions and you have all these weird rules, like, and people want you to put in temporary rules all the time and you want to document them. There's no great way to document in an ASA, for example, you know, rule ownership, not well. And in some of these firewall management products, you can create rule owners and then you can granularly add user access so that they can look at their rules. I mean, it does make it easier. I'm just wondering why aren't the firewall companies giving you this ability themselves?
Because customers aren't asking for it. Seriously.
They're not.
Seriously. Across the industry, a firewall is a plug and pray operation. You plug it in, you configure some rules, and you walk away.
But these companies are making a ton. There's Net Citadel, which used to be Firewall Analyzer, now is going commercial. I mean, there are a lot of these companies out there, but maybe it's just the big financial institutions and bigger organizations who are buying it. I don't know.
Well, up until now, the firewalls have managed to charge a lot of money. So by the time you bought your firewall and paid for your professional services, do you have enough money to then pay for somebody to deploy software and a server? And do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what makes me so angry about the firewall companies, that you're having to buy. It's like, you know, you buy a car, but then you need to go to some other company to be able to drive the car. Like they sell it to you without the seats or something. I mean, it's just,
this is where as I understand the Palo Alto, this is its success. Is it's own management platform, as well as, like, its biggest feature is its visibility into what's happening on the firewall. It provides you with per flow statistics. It tells you what's matching this rule. It tells you all that sort of stuff in the web interface. And that's the Palo Alto success, and that's why they're taking good market shares, because their management platform is a part of the firewall itself.
But you're not going to put you know, my experience is that most people aren't going to put Palo Alto at the perimeter or everywhere. I mean, they're going to mix it up because it's more of an application layer firewall. So,
yeah. I mean, the future, come back to the original point. Software-defined security is going to be real. Somehow we have to take, you know, the five tuple that is a firewall rule and extrapolate it back into a software management system that can put entries into firewalls. And that is going to be part of networking. And so the job of firewalls is no longer going to be an autonomous system or autonomous skill set. It's going to be part of networking. And we're seeing
start
of that.
I'm telling you right now that you tell a bunch of security engineers that when you try to take away their command lines or their pure, like, logging into each device, even though it's like the equivalent of watching grass grow. I mean, when I have brought that up, I've had security engineers say, oh, that's just inefficient, and they've, like, walked away from me, even though it's ridiculous, the idea that you're managing hundreds.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I don't disagree for a single minute, but quite literally that's the same thing about networking 2 years ago when I couldn't have envisaged OpenFlow arriving, which now makes software-defined networking a possibility. The same thing's going to happen to software-defined security, because security is a reaction to a network. Networking is a reaction to wanting to connect two servers together. We don't drive – security and networking don't drive the underlying requirement. We react to the requirements of businesses, so that when the business says, we're going to take all of our servers and put them onto a virtualization stack, and that's all going to be in one layer two domain, there's going to be 10,000 IP addresses in a single VLAN. Now go and secure that and network that and make it safe. That literally is the future. That's the private clouds that you're looking at today, is a trill backbone with 1,000 Ethernet ports plugged into 500 VMware servers running 10-20-1 ratios to give you, you know, 10,000 servers in a single data center, right? Where's your firewall going to go in that? Where's your IDS going to go? And they're all going to be in one flat VLAN. Where's your IDS going to go? Where's your security firewall? Where's your WAN acceleration going to go in that environment? If you're going to use hardware, how are you going to funnel traffic in and out of that hardware device? And how many hardware devices do you need, and where do they need to be if you're going to separate traffic flows in that sort of environment? How are you going to log all the data in that environment and make sense of it? If you're going to have one big-ass firewall in the middle there, how are you going to have NetFlow working when you haven't got any Layer 3 interfaces?
I am pretty sure VMware, with the Nasira purchase, are going to have some kind of an answer for exactly all of those questions.
Yeah, because I hate to break it to you, VMware better, because security people are – you talk virtualization to them, they haven't a clue in most cases. They aren't even having these conversations there's a pocket of people doing it, but it's like you start talking about, okay, let's talk about the strategy and the architecture for security in terms of virtualization, and they're just like,
those guys are all about scale, performance, redundancy, and uplink to storage. How can I move this VM around if something breaks? And storage and securing the guest OS. The guest OSs are incidental. if they're up and they're running and I can move them around wherever I need to move them around to, I'm happy. Security? No, yeah. Not even part of the conversation.
No, I'm talking about security people. Security people are missing the boat. They're just not even – it's not even on their radar to a lot of degrees. I'm consistently surprised at how little a lot of them know about virtualization.
Well, the interesting – I had a briefing this week with Chris Hoff from Juniper. He's their chief security officer. And he was explaining to me about their virtualization strategy, which actually caused me to sit back and have a bit of a think about what that looks like. And what he's saying is that their virtual gateway product, we had a presentation on virtual gateway at Network Field Day 3 earlier in the year, and you should check out the slides from there. It's about a 40-minute presentation. And he's actually saying that their virtual gateway, which is a firewall product that goes into the VMware hypervisor at this time,
right.
Future will be Xen and Hyper-V and all that sort of stuff. And it will actually talk to vCenter, and it will also talk to the neighboring SRX platform. And it will know which security zone it's in because the SRX firewall that it's near tells it which zone it's in.
Yeah, this is their Altor product we talked about. There are other products. Reflex Systems, I think, has one too. I don't know why, but you know what bothers me is a lot of people are not jumping on the boat with, oh, we've got to be hooked into the hypervisor. Sure, you've got hypervisor bypass, but in most cases, you're not doing that. So I don't understand why. So why are we as, you know, and I'm talking about my security peers, we're just not jumping on that. I don't get it.
It's too hard for them at the moment. They're still trying to cope with what they've got. How can you delta forward into the next era when you can't make your current security strategy work? And I think the security industry may have to start realizing that you're just going to have to turn and burn. You're going to have to burn whatever position you're in and turn around and start facing the future challenge instead of looking backwards. I mean, most of the industry, you know, if you take the metaphor, they're sort of walking backwards into the future and saying, well, this is what we've done. We've got to keep it. We've got to fix this and we've got to fix this. And all of a sudden they're backing into a post or a wall behind them. I'm going to be interested to see, like, for example, HP's tipping point continues, as far as I know, to do the intercept and redirect strategy, where they intercept the traffic flow and flip it off to the tipping point IDS for inspection and then flip it back, and that's how they do their firewall.
Yeah, I don't think that's changed.
Yeah, but then NetOptics has that phantom tap, so I think that I really would love to play with one of those where it's a virtual tap.
Well, there are other products, like, for example, Cisco does not the same thing, but conceptually something similar with their VSA, the VASA product, although it's distributed control plane. It does rely on some parts. But it'll be interesting. I mean, I need to think about these things right at the moment because of, you know, I think I'm kind of through the private cloud networking. We know what Trill looks like when we want large layer 2, multipath, Ethernet, high bandwidth domains. I think we know what software-defined networking is going to do with us in terms of laying down we're going to have a software control platform that's going to be able to do configuration management, flow management, architecture, and change the configuration of the devices, move the flows around and account for them. So I can sort of envisage it. It's not here yet, and it might be 2 or 3 years away, but at least I can see how that market's shaping up around, you know, if it's not open flow controllers, it'll be something else, APIs on the routers or APIs on the devices. So the question now is, great, okay, layer 2 sorted, layer 3 sorted, scaling out my switching, software control of my switching and routing network, okay, I'm all good, Trill config, you know, blah, blah, blah. Bugger, where's the firewalls going to go? And that's my next, where do my IPSs sit? Where do my IDSs sit? Where do my firewalls go? And that's what I'm drilling into next. That's what my next research is, so I can envisage what does the next data center look like to me?
Well, there's one more thing to kind of throw on top of that. It's becoming more evident that overlay networks might play a significant might have a significant impact on the network, like Nicira with their SDT or VXLAN. Or Windows Server 2012 looks like it's going to have a pretty significant control plane with NVGRE, which kind of surprised me. I wasn't aware of that until quite recently. So now we're going to have these overlay networks, and how are
but that doesn't mean that they'll work. Okay, so the flip side of these overlay networks is what worked for eBay or Amazon doesn't necessarily translate into something that will work in a private cloud. So it's yet to be, and while I'm not being cynical and I'm not being opposed to them, I think they probably will work. But I don't want to be the person on the front line deploying VXLAN and finding out all of the hassle with, you know, VXLAN's not supported on this network adapter because it doesn't support tow that VXLAN can handle. Or I don't want to be running STT in software and then suddenly finding out that my three-year-old file servers don't do DPDK and can't do SSL and STT encapsulation in CPU. Or, you know, I don't want to be running Hyper-V and realizing that Microsoft's got at least 5 years to go before that works with their NVGRE. And at the same time, the IETF is out there building their own standard, NVO, which is going to be their version of a tunneling protocol, which is standardized. And the IEEE, well, who the hell knows? I mean, they're lost. They're busy off creating the next generation of Layer 2 protocols. So it's all too far away for me to realize. Right now, what I can look at today, I'm sure the tunneling protocols are going to come, but I'm not going to deploy those anytime in the next 12 months. Because even if you did, it'd be beta software. It'd be the first version. It'd be too risky to put in anything but so if you're eBay or Facebook or Google, you've probably got good reasons to try these things in limited, even at scale, because you can automate and test and you've got resources to do. But, you know, we aren't. We're going to be – so, you know, overlay networking doesn't appear on my radar, but getting firewalls into those environments – building big layer 2 domains, big, fat, fast 10 gig layer 2 domains. Yeah, I need that. And then I need the layer 3 networking. I need the routing. I need to work out how my switches are going to go. Where am I going to plug those 500 servers into my data center? What is my VMware stack going to look like? How am I going to know where those servers are? And then how am I going to put firewalls in front of it? How am I going to zone this stuff in such a way that it's meaningfully security zoned so that, you know, when a developer's sitting on a machine – and he's on the same private cloud that's got reach into my production site, how do I make sure that the developer doesn't do something dumb, you know, do the wrong thing or make a mistake or something like that? I don't have answers to those yet.
And whatever answers are out there, none of them are mature at this point, as you said. So it's a risk to a network designer to put any of these solutions in place today because it's going to change. It keeps changing.
Yeah, but not only that, Ethan, you got to remember the other problem is that if you're in the financial part and you've got to deal with compliance, or you got to get the auditor's permission on how you build that cloud. I mean, you can't put PCI and non-PCI data on the same VMware cluster. You have to have separate clusters. I'm not kidding. Sometimes they tell you, and so then you're going back, you know, you want to go move towards the future, and then they're telling you
you need to shit a firewall every time you walk five steps. I mean, oh, nope, you need another firewall here. Nope, firewall.
Yeah, well, I'm actually thinking at the moment my preferred solution is to put an IPS everywhere and call it a firewall. And say this is,
or you could buy an Ethernet.
IPSs are definitely the answer to every problem, not because they suck.
No, the problem I've got is that I can't find anybody who understands what an IPS does in real life. So keeping them tuned and running, I just don't trust the security people who run my IPSs to actually be bright enough.
Well, it's the signatures. The signatures as the signature industry. Blows chunks. They do not work. That's why AV is such a joke, right? So yeah. IPSs, they can suck it.
But they're better than a firewall. They deliver more function than a firewall.
No, they break more than a firewall. That's all. They're just, you know, more obnoxious. Do you want the kid who cries all the time, or do you want the kid who's like wreaking havoc, but you don't know? So
don't have kids.
What do you say we put a lid on this 2-hour marathon Packet Pushers podcast that's probably going to have to get published as two shows, because there ain't no way I'm going to sit and edit 2 hours worth of this in one shot, because that's a day, man. This is going to be two shows. I am pretty darn sure. Oh, man. Okay. So, Tony, at TBOURKE at dataoverlords.com. Is that right? Oh, that's from memory. So good. It's actually because I follow you and read your stuff. What are you going to be working on this week, man? Are you still training, flying around the world? What's going on?
Actually, I was supposed to go to Montreal this week, but the trip got canceled, so I'm home all week. Training for the marathon in Australia, and I think on Tuesday I'm going to go up to Seattle and to do aerobatics and fly an airplane upside down and do loops and stuff, so that should be
sweet.
Fun.
Now, will you wear a cardigan and a tie when you do that, the loop-the-loops?
No, I'll probably have
Flight suit with like a leather helmet and big goggles. That's what I want to picture you as in my mind. That'll be sweet. Mr. Hollingsworth, sir. How does it...
Tony is Tom Cruise. That's what
Mr. Hollingsworth in Oklahoma, where it's really hot. What's the week hold for you?
Well, this week my boss is on vacation, so I am going to be camped out close to the office to make sure nothing catches on fire. And I'm also going to be trying to keep up with what's going on at VMworld and see if there's any exciting new announcements that are going to radically change my view of virtualization for the next 2 months.
At Networking Nerd and at networkingnerd.net?
Net.
Not net. Awesome. And Mr. Kurt, you started out the show in jammies and then announced in the Skype back channel that you are now in your suit, which I found disturbing. And then you sent us a picture of the jammies, which was similarly disturbing. So now that you're in your suit, where are you headed off to? What you going to be working on?
This week, meetings, and finishing up the first milestone of the QFabric data center deployment. Hopefully working with one of my co-workers, Cooper Lees, on actually getting some blog posts about QFabric out there.
Can we convince you to put them on PackagePusher?
Probably.
We'd be interested in that.
I'm sure we'll do something.
I've done some shows with Chris Margit and Tony Matke and some other guys regarding Nexus, and we're looking for some of that kind of stuff for some of the other product lines, so maybe I could convince you and Cooper to come on and do sort of a deep dive on QFabric at some point. I think people might be interested in that. Yeah. We'll see.
Oh, I'd love that.
Okay.
That'd be good.
That would be interesting. Maybe we put that together.
Yeah, the Nexus shows were great.
Okay. Michelle, of course, is really become a host of her own show here, the Healthy Paranoia podcast. And what content have you got planned in the pipeline for that?
I'm working on a show, an IPv6 security show. I've been trying to catch some of these security researchers and pin them down as like trying to grab air or, you know, quantify the sound of one hand clapping. It's really been difficult. That's one of the shows that I'm working on. I have also been in talks with the ADA initiative and some female engineers so we can have an estrogen-only show and talk about what that's like. I think it's time. I've also been in talks with some people. I want to get the builders and the breakers around the table together so that we can have interesting conversations about what's wrong, and then I think we can inform each other on how to fix it and have better conversations and not just that, you know, turn into arguments and, no, you don't know what you're talking about. No, you don't know what you're talking about. So that's pretty much what I've been working on, gathering guests together and for new shows and editing that Hackerspace show that we did last weekend.
So if you hadn't followed that, I mean, go to packetpushers.net. Healthy Paranoia is there, as is Tony Bork's show, Wrath of Data Center, where he sporadically does a podcast on how he's doing with the CCIE data center certification. Tony, do you happen to have anything coming up on that one?
Was a little bit of a hiatus while I think I might have started the podcast a bit prematurely. So we're a little bit of a hiatus until we find out who passed and who didn't pass the written beta. And then when we get on from that, we're going to be talking about the different components like the Nexus deep dives, the ACE deep dives, MDS deep dives, etc. So probably in another couple weeks, we'll start back up again.
Greg, the day job treating you well?
Yes, the day job is treating me well. Thank you. It's a very fine job. Lots of great challenges, and there are some really great people. Now that I'm settling in there, I'm starting to understand what's going on. I'm also doing some writing for Information Week, which has been very hard, very new challenge, and that's getting on. And then, of course, I've just accepted Network Field Day 4, so I'll be in San Jose in the second week of October, hanging around with the other bloggers to meet the vendors. So if any vendors are still listening at this point, this is your chance to get in contact. Generally just trying to survive. so that I can get just keep everything going. We've had a very busy time. I've been busy, you've been busy, and so some of the content on Packet Pushers has slowed down a little, and, you know, that's just the way it works. So if we only had more hours in a day, then life would be better, wouldn't
well,
it?
Well, and yet another excuse to split this one up into two different shows.
Yes.
So Greg, of course, on Twitter is at etherealmind and blogs at etherealmind.com and occasionally on packetpushers.net as well, as do I. I am at ecbanks on Twitter, and I blog exclusively at packetpushers.net for my blog stuff. Actually, I don't blog exclusively there because I'm also at Tech Target and other places like CCIE Flyer. Anyway.
Should call out for Ivan Pepunyak, who is at ipspace.net, of course, and you can find him and his very fine webinars there, and also on his Twitter handle at iOS Hints, which was the previous name for his blog before he, and Ivan is, of course, is the smartest one on the show.
Yeah, Ivan had to drop off a little bit early and out of my Skype frame, out of my mind, which is embarrassing. Wow. Thank you for remembering him. And so, hey, we're going to wrap up the show there for today. All of you fine listeners, thank you very much for listening. We mean that. And if you liked what you heard, please tell coworkers, your Twitter followers, Facebook friends, LinkedIn contacts, random people in crowded places, all about the Packet Pushers podcast. Don't forget that packetpushers.net is home to a community of bloggers that write nerdy networking stuff so you can learn from that or be amused by it. So stop by and see what's going on. And hey, let us know if you'd like to blog with us by sending an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and that same address if you have questions about this show. So, thank you for letting us take up some of your valuable bandwidth, and remember that too much networking would never be enough.
Never-ending Packet Pushers Podcast.